on this edition of The Self-Publishing Show.
What we are asking is not for people to give us money. We're actually offering them a way of pre-ordering our books that include all kinds of interesting ancillary goodies that they might get if we reach certain stretch goals. And that's the real secret of Kickstarter.
Publishing is changing. No more gatekeepers. No more barriers. No one standing between you and your readers. Do you want to make a living from your writing? Join indie bestseller Mark Dawson and first-time author James Blatch as they shine a light on the secrets of self-publishing success. This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Hello and welcome to The Self-Publishing Show with James Blatch.
And Mark Dawson.
And we are both representing today, aren't we?
We are, yes. I was in a shirt this morning. I was playing football with my son and he ripped the shirt right down the middle.
Was that looking?
He's very sweet, isn't it? It's a very old shirt. And he said, I said, I'm just going to throw it away. He said, don't throw it away, Daddy. You look good in it.
Very
much. So, that's very sweet. But no, I'm wearing my own brand today, which is
a bit meta. Sounded like it could have been a yellow card.
I think it was a red card, basically. Yeah,
red card, he's off.
That kind of behaviour, he's straight off.
Okay, yes. Well, we should say about our merch that Amazon is, in fact, this will bring us neatly onto one of our first topics of conversation today, that Amazon is struggling to get a merch done in the United States as we speak with the COVID-19 situation. They are, I think, still operating, albeit with delays in the UK, but you'll have to bear with us if you're after that. Very nice T-shirt. Time will pass before you'll be able to order again in the US. We'll try and update the merch tab on our website with that. That sort of brings us on to a topic that's been hot in our Facebook groups and other Facebook groups this week, which is Amazon has been a tad glitchy over the last 3 or 4 days. Go home, Amazon, you're drunk. This started, I think, about 4 days ago or 5 days ago when somebody posted into, I think, the 20 Books group and said, hey, has anybody else found their book going to zero? I've just seen it's been given away for free and I didn't change it to zero. And that started a lot of other people saying, oh, yeah, this has happened to me. And it looked to me, Mark, reading the messages, as if it was affecting people who'd made some changes to their book in the KDP dashboard. And even uncommanded change added into that was it went to zero.
It seemed that way. It didn't affect me, so I can't comment on that one. Although I've had my own issues with Amazon this week, but it did. It wasn't isolated. There were quite a few people who saw their book went to zero. I think pre-orders as well were going to zero. So a lot of people were worried. Were they going to lose money? And I haven't spoken to Amazon about this, but I would be, I wouldn't worry too much. I'd be very, very surprised if, well, first of all, I believe they know it's an issue, and I'd be very surprised if when they fixed it, that it doesn't mean that those sales that should have happened will be credited at the price they're supposed to be credited at. So I wouldn't worry too much. Frustrating and a bit worrying sometimes. But a
difficulty with that, though, because let's say you... I suppose they could use averages, couldn't they? Let's say you sell 25 books a day on average and you push out 250 when it's marked to free for 2 days.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I just think you could argue they just have to run all of those because those books were downloaded at a price that they set that you hadn't changed the list price. I don't really know. I mean, I'm not thinking about that in legal terms, but I suspect Amazon will do the right thing on that and that will all get sorted out.
Otherwise, you will underwrite it.
Yeah, that's right.
You'll personally pay everybody for any losses incurred.
There have been a few issues. So others may have noticed this too. I've got a pre-order coming up and I changed the blurb. So I had a kind of a placeholder blurb, which I wanted to change for the real thing. And I did it, as we record this, on Monday the 4th, May the 4th, Happy Star Wars Day. It's been 4 days, I think, and it's just stuck in review. It's really annoying. Also, there's the print version of this book that's coming out whenever I can has been stuck in review for about the same time. And I've got a BookBub on Wednesday on the 6th, and I changed the price on Saturday, and that's still in review. So the review process is basically broken at the moment.
Let me just say that This has come on quite quickly because I did some changes, new cover, new blurb to one of our books in Fuse. Must have been Monday or Tuesday last week, and that went through absolutely fine very quickly. I mean, I think I got the approval the next day, which is about right. But suddenly, Friday or something like that last week, it all started becoming glitchy. So some cleaner somewhere has unplugged a computer to put their vacuum cleaner in.
Something like that. So yes, I do have a pre-order coming up, and I want that to go live this week if I can, because I think that'll be best for the launch. And
this is a Milton book.
It is a Milton book. Yes,
17th.
So I've got this the 16th.
16th.
16th Milton book. Yeah. So it's people really want it. The advanced readers have been really positive, which is always lovely. So it's ready to go pretty much. The manuscript is done. The vellum is done. Everything is ready. But it's, you know, and I set the pre-order date a year in advance, so it's, I set it in September last year, so I've got until this September, but I'm ready to go now. So I'm just waiting for this blurb to be approved. Of course, once that's approved, I'll then have to upload the correct manuscript, and then click, you know, get it approved again. So it's entirely possible that this won't be approved for another day or two. I'll then have another 4 days to wait whilst, you know, we're going to be into next week before we know it. So I've dropped an email to some Amazonians who I think might be able to help. So hopefully they'll be able to give it a kick, switch it on and switch it off again, always the best policy.
Yeah, exactly. And just so I understand how we understand how this works, the pre-order, you get a year. During that year, I think they've done some extensions actually because of COVID, but anyway, during that year, you've got to make the book live at some point in those 12 months. But the date, sort of the year point, when you put your book up for pre-order, do you put a date, public-facing date, of the date it's going go live?
Yeah, so on the website, it says September 2020.
And you chose that, and that was the maximum length you could have had under the Amazon rules, and you chose that
date. Yes, I knew it would be ready in advance of that, but I wanted to run the pre-orders. But I could just hoover up sales, and you know, 13,000 pre-orders is pretty healthy. But yeah, I knew there'd be no pressure in having that out there. I could have set a date 6 months from, you know, when I put it up for pre-order, but that would have put me under a little bit of pressure that wasn't necessary. So I just like it to be as long as possible, so I can then push the button when I'm ready to go, knowing that there's no possibility that I'll miss the backstop date. The only issue with that is that the date is on Amazon, and I've had lots of readers, when I say to them in emails that the book will be out next week, they'll go, I've just been to Amazon and it says September 2020, even though I've got in the email I said ignore that date, and even on the actual Amazon page it says this date is wrong. They still don't see that sometimes, and I've had to be dealing with that.
That is a slight downside of doing it that way, because readers will always see that date.
Very, very, very small. I mean, yeah. You can. It's easy to correct. Just email back and say, "Don't worry, Amazon's wrong. I'm right. Yes. It'll be out next week." Well, hopefully about this week. We'll see.
Good. And I haven't seen anything today. I haven't had a chance to look in the forums today, but to see what the situation is. But your understanding is on as it is May the 4th with you day, that Amazon is still glitchy.
Well, I only in as far as I can comment on my own experience, and those books haven't been approved yet. So yes, there seems to be slow. So if you've got a book bub coming up, I change the price as soon as you can.
Because
at the moment, I'm not entirely sure it'll be ready when the book bub live goes live on the 6th.
Well, you won't be the only person in that position, so I'm sure they won't. They'll be easy on you at Boston Towers.
But, no, they won't. Yeah. They'll jump on me.
How are you?
We'll see.
Yeah, do you know what? This sort of thing happens from time to time. It happens more in a complex online environment than it used to happen in bookshops. Well, I'm quite certain they shipped 25,000 books of somebody's autobiography in the 1980s and priced them up wrong in the shops for 2 weeks before anyone noticed. It's the sort of thing that does happen from time to time, and we have to make some allowances. Okay, right. We are going to have a quick chat about the Amazon Ads course. And the reason for that is that I'm really heads down editing it this morning. I've been going through the modules and the sessions. It's shaping up to be, it's structured in a slightly different way from most of our courses, shorter sessions and more of them. but it's a really, really good course. And as somebody who's now running Amazon Ads in Anger for our Fuse Books series, I'm starting to really lap it up. I'm really excited about this course. So Janet Margot, just to remind people, we've recruited Janet Margot straight from Amazon. She was at the coalface, the person helping to design this very platform. She's now moved to another part of the vast Amazon empire, which leaves her free to be the tutor for you, to teach you how to use this platform that she had a hand in creating. And it's exciting. It's shaping up very nicely. We're going to have it ready for June. I'm pretty certain about that now, which is the date we've got in mind for opening up Ads for Authors, the very beginning of June. And I know you're keeping an eye across it as well. Mark, I see your comments in the vast spreadsheet we have, which is the production side of bringing a course to fruition. There's a few notes from you going back with some extra examples, using our experience of putting courses together and helping Janet with that side of it.
Yes, yeah. So Janet has, Janet knows as much as anybody in the world about Amazon Ads for Authors, because that's what she did. She set up the books program in Amazon advertising. So she's very knowledgeable. And so you combine that with our expertise when it comes to making courses look swish. Plus, of course, I'll be doing some stuff in the course as well. So things like keyword research, that's something that I'm quite good at. So we'll have some sessions with me, but it'll be mostly with Janet. It's going to be really good. I mean, we've said before, anyone who's already a member of the Ads for Authors course will get that. You'll just see that will appear in your teachable school. And it will be something that we'll be offering as a part of the new course when it goes live in June. So definitely, I'm pretty excited. I mean, I'm excited about it, because I think Janet will show me things I didn't know. So
yeah,
be very good. And one of the things that we've got is a webinar coming up. So we'll be doing some webinars during the launch period, and Janet is doing one for us. It's on Tuesday, the 9th of June. It's at London time, 9 p.m., New York time, 4 p.m., Los Angeles time, 1 p.m. We'll be looking at six secrets to Amazon Ads success. So with me and Janet, hosted by your good self, and we're going to be looking at how to start off small and scale up effectively, whether ad relevance or the highest bid is more important, how to develop key learnings. I hate that word. Key learnings is almost like journey, on what works for your books, and that simplicity is often key to a successful Amazon ad. And there'll be a Q&A at the end. So it'll be basically me, Janet, and James. So you'll be able to ask us about Amazon ads, Facebook ads, for me, anything else really. And you can ask James, I'm sure James can answer some questions about some things, not quite sure what.
I can tell you I'm showing a profit on my Amazon ads, so I'm pretty much cracked that.
Very good. So it's going to be good. And the what did we say the URL was going to be?
It's going to be Six Secrets. So selfpublishingformula.com/six secrets, SIXSECRETS, not to be confused with selfpublishingformula.com/sex secrets, which is John's personal page. Don't go there. Selfpublishingformula.com.
Yes, no, definitely don't go there.
/six secrets. All one word. We'll probably put the digit six version out there as well, just to and that'll be a place where you can sign up for the webinar completely free, of course, as Mark says, June the 9th, but get in early. We've got 1,000 spots available, because that's our limit on our go-to webinar account, and it would not surprise me if this is the webinar that busts that top limit.
Well, we've already done that once. We have had a webinar that was full once, so this one definitely will be full. I don't think there's any question about that. So,
and just to explain how that works, you can register. In fact, we can register thousands and thousands of people. It's a limit on attendees. So basically, it's getting in early, getting there. If you get there on time or a few minutes before, in the past, you've always been guaranteed a slot. It's the last 10 minutes once we've started normally where it fills up and goes over the top, but...
We had a few people sending us angry emails with screen grabs of a little GoToWebinar dialog box that said this webinar is full. So this isn't us, it's not BS.
No.
It's 1,000 people, and that's the limit that we have. So definitely register, and then make sure that you are there, quarter to nine UK time on the 9th. So yes, we're looking forward to that one.
Okay, right. Look, let's move on to today's interview. It's with a man called Nicholas Kotar, a very interesting guy. He's a first generation Russian immigrant family in the US, and he's wears his heritage very proudly, but he is also a very entrepreneurial guy, very motivated, and he's somebody who has used crowdfunding to fund his fiction book. Now, this is something that does take place from time to time. More often, I would say, with nonfiction, certainly nonfiction products, but it can work for fiction, but it works in a particular way. And Nick has really laid that open for us in this interview, really gone into detail. It's another way of doing things. It's a way of building a fan base at the same time as writing the book, really super fans who feel invested in your book and of making the book profitable right from the start, a bit like pre-orders. So let's hear from Nick, and then Mark and I can have a quick chat off the back of that.
This is the Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Nick, hello and welcome to the Self-Publishing Show. Oh, that was an extreme close-up. That was,
I'm sorry.
Do you remember Wayne's World? They used to do that extreme close-up.
Yes, exactly.
That was what that was. Okay, well, that's a good way to say hello. We should do a formal welcome then to the show, and you're joining us from, oh, remind me where, you're in the US somewhere.
Yeah, I call it cow country because that's about as close as anybody knows. It's near Cooperstown, New York, which is known only for its for the fact of it being the Baseball Hall of Fame. But other than that, nobody knows where it
is. Yes, so. I must go there one day. The whole town's built around the Baseball Hall of Fame,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Wow. Good. Okay. Well, there's a trip for me one day when the travel restrictions eventually get lifted.
Oh, good grief! Yeah,
recording this in the middle of it all, but hopefully by the time this goes out, maybe things have settled down. Okay. Now we're going to talk a bit about you, but a bit about an unusual approach to funding your writing career, which is, I think, what we're going to get some instruction about. But let's start with you, Nick. An interesting career. You're multi-talented. You're a bit of a Renaissance man.
That's what I try. Yeah.
So tell us about you.
Well, I've been writing, as many people probably say on this show, for since I was a kid. But in terms of actually writing for a living, it's been a very long and kind of convoluted journey. Currently, I consider myself to be a full-time creative, but it's from a wide variety of different sources. I translate from Russian to English. I write fiction. I speak. I give online workshops. I sing professionally. And I conduct a men's choir for which I receive not that much money, but I kind of see that as my as the center of my creative life on a regular basis. And I'm sure there's a few more things that I'm forgetting at the moment.
Did you mention your translation?
I did. Oh, did. Okay. I translate from Russian to English.
Which is amazing. So you're fluent in Russian, I presume.
It was actually my first language. Even though I was born in San Francisco, I spoke nothing but Russian until I was 5.
Wow.
There's a story there. My parents come from immigrant stock. My grandparents had to immigrate from Russia after the revolution. And they felt very strongly about keeping the culture and the language intact, especially in America, where people tend to lose that very quickly. And I'm doing that with my kids now, too. My 3 kids speak only Russian.
They speak only Russian?
Well, my eldest is starting to catch up on the English because it happens very quickly. It's much easier to lose the Russian than it is to gain.
Wow, English, that must be quite something. Yeah, I've got friends who are bilingual and they do something where they'll speak one language at home, usually the language of the country they're not in. So if their English family in France, they'll speak English in the house and then French outside it, something like that. So yeah, that's a really good thing to do. I mean, I'm a lazy Englishman, so I obviously only barely speak English, but what a great advantage for a child to grow up with, it being bilingual. It doesn't matter what the other language is, actually. Yeah. I think that's great. Okay, well, look, let's talk a bit about your writing then. So I think it's fairy tales. Is that, or that's at least one of your specialist areas, and perhaps fantasy is your...
Yeah, I'm sort of between genres. I think technically speaking, what I write is fantasy, but practically speaking, I take a lot of inspiration from Russian fairy tales, and the way I structure my stories is very much along traditional fairy tale structures. And oftentimes I get story elements or plot elements or characters from the old Russian fairy tales. And I think there's a lot of there's a lot of good crossover between the two genres. But I technically speaking, if we're talking about Amazon genres, I don't think I fit exactly into the fairy tale one, because usually what sells in the fairy tale section is happily ever after retellings of a Cinderella tale, and oftentimes they'll have a princess in a ball gown as the cover, and that's sort of what people look for when they go to the fairy tale section. So technically, I skew closer to the epic fantasy scale of things.
Okay, I guess in their origins, they're both. I mean, one of the great things about fairy tales is they're quite sinister. I mean, you're a kid, you're quite drawn to that dark side of poisoning young, beautiful women, or all the things that happen in fairy tales. It's quite, I mean, you use the word grim, of course, the Grimm brothers, but they were quite grim, and they've been used a lot in more modern terms in comic books and retellings, dark retellings. There was quite a violent Hansel and Gretel not that long ago. Yes, I can see that the epic fantasy has, I can see where the origins work for both, but yeah, because of that child's connection. And epic fantasy, is this conform to genre in that quite long books?
They're actually not. And this is the one aspect where I kind of go countercultural. They're pretty self-contained. I think for most people who look for the doorstopper experience of the extremely rich world building, that's not quite what I do. I like a lot more streamlined kind of approach to the plot, where the world building happens a little more naturally as the characters go through the world. And I don't, to be honest, and maybe I shouldn't be saying this, but I kind of get annoyed with the really, really long epic fantasy because oftentimes it's just world building for world building's sake. And, you know, we really don't have all that many hours in a given day, and there's so many books out there. You know, I'd rather get to the story more quickly.
So now I've been mulling that question today, actually, because I've been thinking of, through a sort of science fiction ideas that I've been having, some sort of in-between ideas at the moment. And I often mention Ian M. Banks because I love his science fiction writing. And what I think he does with science fiction is he doesn't spend any world-building time. The world-building is all incidental. You learn it through the story, and it's a normal size book and a normal size story. But you can do the opposite of that. You can spend a lot of time because you think, well, people don't understand how the society works here, so I have to explain that. But that's much more interesting when that's incidental to the story.
That's what I think, but I do recognize that a lot of epic fantasy readers read epic fantasy specifically for those asides. I'm just not one of them.
So, okay, so let's talk about this fundraising scheme that you had. So when did you decide to do that?
So, I mean, as with so many things with the writer's career, this one is almost a story in itself. You know, I'm a dedicated follower of this podcast, of Joanna Penn's podcast, and a lot of the other sort of bright and shining lights in the indie movement. The reason I'm indie is another story, but we're not going to get into that. So I tried a lot of different things. I'm only about 3 years into this as an indie, so it's pretty early days, so to speak. And I put my hand into every single pie that I could, especially initially, just to see what worked and what didn't. And there was one, I was involved with Instafreebie while they were still Instafreebie. And they had this strange email that came out, and I'm not sure that everybody got it. I think it was to a small subset of their people that basically said, would you be interested in a pilot course for crowdfunding, for fiction specifically? And if you'd be interested, would you take a course with us, right? And so I kind of just filled it out, thought, yeah, nothing's going to happen. And a few weeks later, I was one of 15 people chosen for their pilot crowdfunding course. And it was done in total secrecy. Nobody knew about it. It was a kind of their attempt to make this into something that I think would become profitable for them at some point. So I was in at the ground level with an author, Jay Swanson.
Jay Swanson.
Yeah, he had done a few crowdfunding things. And so he was pretty good at it. But none of us really knew what to expect because it was a first time thing. And there was a lot of negative press surrounding crowdfunding as an approach for marketing for fiction specifically, and pretty much anybody you would talk to would tell you don't even try because it only works for nonfiction. That was sort of the party line that everybody was spreading around. But because it was offered and because it was free, I thought, well, why not? And so that's how I got into it. It ended up being very successful. So we can get into the details of how that happened.
Yeah, well, I'm interested in that because I think people would think of it for nonfiction for obvious reasons, particularly nonfiction genre, you know, areas that are going to potentially reward the person investing, you know,
right,
by learning something that's going to enhance their career. And when we think of crowdfunding for fiction and creative stuff, it's normally lower level, like Patreon is an example, isn't it? Etsy and so on. So But you did take this to the next go. Now, how did you set about? What did you? What was the offer?
Well, that's the interesting thing. So, the first thing that we had to understand from the very beginning is we had to unlearn a bunch of things that we thought we understood about crowdfunding fiction specifically, because so many people equate crowdfunding with charity, specifically because of GoFundMe and other such platforms that oftentimes are set up for people in tragic circumstances. Kickstarter specifically, and it wasn't just crowdfunding, it was Kickstarter specifically, is a different platform entirely because it has its own sort of social aspect. A lot of people go to Kickstarter specifically for everything that they need, whether it's practical things, whether it's interesting new ideas, whether it's books, as it turns out. So the thing we all had to understand from the very beginning was that what we are asking is not for people to give us money. We're actually offering them a way of pre-ordering our books that include all kinds of interesting ancillary goodies that they might get if we reach certain stretch goals. And that's the real secret of Kickstarter, as it turns out, is that it's not merely a platform for to get money from people who are interested in buying your books. It's a platform for that, but it's also a platform for people who like the community building aspect of reading and of storytelling. So if you are then, as I was, able to frame the whole ask in a way that emphasized the community story building aspect of it, there's a real response to it. It was quite shocking, actually. I ended up overfunding by a lot.
Wow. So how did you set it out? What were the extra sort of community goodies that you got?
Well, I started out by making sure in the video that I did, and by the way, the video is very important. We can talk more about the video later, about the specifics of it. But I made sure to focus on the reader, not on me. And this is the real thing that a lot of people don't think about. It's not about me. It's not about me as the author. I don't need your help. You need my help, actually. And so this is how you have to find an angle in which you look at the journey of the reader as a kind of hero's journey. So the hero, who is the reader, has a problem, and that problem can actually be answered very easily with fiction. We just don't think of it in those terms. Most of the time, it's a matter of entertainment. But I did it a little bit differently. I decided that I would focus on an ask that I was sure nobody else was doing. And that was, how would you like to participate in the creation of a story at the very beginning? How would you like to be one of the people who actually have input into the directions that the characters go, into the names that they get, into the mythical creatures that I choose? And that ask was the entry point. So it was interesting and different enough, and people automatically recognized that I wasn't asking them for money, that I was offering them an experience. And so that's what got them past my video and into the actual sales page. And then when they got to the sales page, that's when I hooked them, because I included some pretty insane goodies. I gave them the option of entering at a certain tier level. They were automatically entered into a drawing where they would win a custom-made, personally forged sword that was worth over $2,000.
Wow.
Yeah. And I had there was a few other things, including a little stone carving of one of the characters in the novel that was done by an actual stone carver that was also given free to one of the people who entered at a certain tier level. So there were two giveaways that were automatically for free. I also, one of the stretch goals included audiobooks, which a lot of people I know contributed specifically because of that, because they wanted to see the audiobooks made, as well as hardcovers, which also interested some people because it's not very often that independent publishers actually go the route of the hardcover. So those were things that helped. But ultimately, I think what really ensured the success of the project was the fact that I had really good covers, that I had really good copy, and that I emphasized again and again the community building aspect of it and reinforced it at every single tier. So it was like I was leading them through a long story. Like, my sales page was actually a story, and they were the heroes in the story, not me. And that's hard to do in a crowdfunding context, because you're inevitably going to think of yourself as the hero because you want to win, but it's not. You're not the hero. They're the hero, and you have to. And it's hard to do that because at some point you have to actually include your own struggles in as part of the ask. So at some point you do have to give the ask. It's not entirely about them. It's about us. But if you can manage to make it about us, then there's more likelihood that people are interested.
So this unfolded on the sales page with the sort of stretch points, you call them, as opt-ins at various points of this story, how far you wanted to go?
So the way that the stretch goals work on Kickstarter specifically is if you reach a certain financial goal above your minimum, then automatically those goals come into effect. So, I was funding at $7,500. And if you reach 10,000, then one thing happens automatically. Then if you reach 15, another thing happens automatically, 20, and so on. And so that provides it also with a kind of entertainment aspect, because if you're invested in it, you want to see how far it can go, especially if you're one of the backers and there's a chance you're going to get an audiobook version of all five books. And it was a five book series. Also, what helped was that I had three of the books already written and two of them published. So I was able to show the people a track record of success, because there is some negative press around fiction Kickstarters in that there is a fairly frequent, I don't have any numbers, but there is this kind of, in the zeitgeist, there's this understanding that some authors don't fulfill their promises even after they've funded.
A big no-no.
Yeah. And you have to, so basically you have to, there's a lot of objections that you have to overcome on the part of the reader. But if you're able to do that, they're willing to help you, honestly. It's interesting. Yeah.
And the good thing about that particular methodology is that the people who've backed you and want to see the goals achieved for their own gain are going to be your ambassadors, aren't they? They're going to sell the project to other people.
And what's interesting is that they're actually a community in and of themselves, a community that doesn't generally buy books on Amazon, that doesn't generally buy books in other places. So it's another niche, it's another community that you can build. And if you sustain it well, they will be interested in what you do for the long term. So it's not merely for this one project. You can actually carry them on to become either your subscribers or your Patreon supporters or other things. It's a fairly easy ask, because if you've given them all these things, much of which is actually free, and that also depends on how you do the tiers. You have to make sure that you're giving people value for the money. But if you do, they'll be willing to follow you for a long time.
Yeah. So let's get some details here. How much did you ask for the various points and offers, and how much did you raise?
Well, I raised over $25,000. I intended to raise $7,500, and I raised over $25,000. I was completely flabbergasted by it. I didn't expect it to happen at all. In fact, the $7,500 ask was rather high. The people that were the people that were in the course, most of them had a much lower ask, and it was a bit of a risk. But because of those things, I ended up overfunding much more. And I think the key to why I overfunded as much as I did was, in addition to all the other things that I said, was actually something that you don't often see in fiction Kickstarters. And that's that I was very careful about pricing my books correctly. Because if you look at, and if you do some research on fiction Kickstarters that are out there, very often they'll offer an ebook version of the book that they're trying to fundraise for something like $10 or $15, right, and the paperback version for $25, $30. The simple fact of that is that that's not much of an incentive for a pre-order, because they can just wait for the book to be published and buy it on Amazon for much less. And that's, even if they don't end up buying it on Amazon, that's their thought process automatically. And in all honesty, right now people are looking for good deals more than anything, and the reality of the coronavirus is only going to make that even worse. So I was very careful about pricing my ebooks at about the same level as they would be on Amazon. So it's a much lower ask than most people would do for an ebook, but I did it on purpose. But I made sure in my video to specifically direct them not to the lowest tier. So in my call to action in the video, I made sure to direct them to the best deal that I had, which was all five of my ebooks for $20. which is a really good deal. It's a lot less than it would be if you bought them individually on Amazon. So it's not even the same amount as it would be on Amazon. It's a significant discount. So, and I directed them to that. And in the process of directing them to that tier, the next tier that I had that was really popular was actually the $100 tier, which was all of my paperbacks signed, all five of them for $100, which is, again, a lot less than you would pay for five paperbacks. Yeah, and I had a lot of $100 backers, as they're called. They're called backers on Kickstarter. And what I did to make sure that more people went to the $100 one is that I made the $100 and up an automatic entry for the sword. And I'm completely convinced that the sword did most of my work for me because I included actual pictures from the work of the forger, who's a Canadian, a really great guy named Jeff Helms. He's a fantastic forger. A swordsmith, I guess you'd call him. And just to have the pictures out there in the sales page, I mean, they're impressive. And you know, you could win it for free and it's only $100. So, you know, why not? And that ended up working in my favor.
And did you get a couple of these? I'm assuming they'd be made out of beryllium steel. Is that what they had in Game of Thrones, beryllium steel? did you get a couple of these made? So you've got one.
I don't. Can you imagine?
Wow. You just had this one and it's now, it's presumably now gone out.
Yeah. It's gone. I don't have it. So I was willing to give it up to somebody else because, you know, to make two or three, it would have been prohibitively expensive.
So what's interesting about this to me is the way you're describing it is it's not so much setting up the, you know, a good sales page and the mechanics of it and what the price points. It's about this story, this narrative, this thing, this event that people were happy to be a part of. That's what seemed to have made it work.
Well, that's the entry point, right? So if you can catch people's attention with a good narrative, then they're willing to cut you some slack. But that being said, if you then provide them with a sales page that's sloppy or with tiers of support that are not a good enough value, they're not going to last very long. They might get to the bottom of the sales page and then decide, yeah, I kind of like what he's doing, but I'll just wait for the book to be published. It's safer that way.
Yeah.
You're dealing with a lot of objections and you have to take care of all of them. So it means having very good covers. You know, my, I guess you would call it I don't know what they would call it, but basically the photo that opened my page, it was like the title photo and you clicked on it, then the video started, was three of my covers, which were designed by Stuart Bache of all people,
of course.
Who had not done fantasy up to that point. So this was a kind of an interesting experiment for him as well. But they were fantastic, obviously. And they grabbed people's attention immediately. Then the story was good. And then I just took them through this story. And at every point, I made sure to tell them this is to show them rather than tell them that this is actually a very good deal. And this is something you're not going to get anywhere else. And the subject matter, the fact that it was Slavic fantasy, was different and appealing enough for people to stick with me longer.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to look up these covers now. And so you could just give us the title and pen name of the book so people can look that up whilst we're talking.
The series is called the Raven Sun series. And the first novel is The Song of the Siren. That's spelled S-I-R-I-N.
Okay, so I've just got the books up on the screen here and having a look at them. Yeah, fantastic covers, very striking. Okay, so you'd written it was a 5-book series. That's what the project was funding, the Kickstarter was funding.
Yeah.
You'd written a couple but hadn't published, is that right?
I'd published the first two.
Okay, the first two were published.
And the third was finished but wasn't published yet. So they had an immediate incentive to support me because as soon as they would receive book three, which was just about to be published.
Okay.
So there was also that kind of limited time offer aspect of it. And it wasn't just, you know, fund me for the future and someday I'll get you the book. It was, I will get you a book now. In fact, I'll give you three of them.
Yeah.
So
people who did the $100, the signed hardback copies, is that right? Or signed paperback copies. They got the first three almost straight away.
Yeah. Yeah,
and then waited for the next two. And have you done the next two now?
Well, I'm almost done with book five. So
okay.
This is my one minus for all of this is that I wasn't realistic with my with how fast I could finish it. So I'm about a year behind.
Okay.
But to be honest, because I gave them so much value so early on, I've had one person complaining And the rest of them just occasionally write me an email saying, I love your books. When is the fifth one coming out? Yep. Not that I'm pushing you. They're saying, I'm not pushing you. Just I'm just curious to know. So it's been, yeah, it's been a very positive experience overall.
Okay. So did it have a knock-on effect to sales outside the Kickstarter once they were published?
Well, not immediately. And this is what's interesting is that I was, the way I looked at it was this was an opportunity because I had so much more money than I anticipated. It was an opportunity for me to buy a lot of educational materials and to start saving up money for the future. So I didn't expect it to have an immediate effect on sales because the difference between a Kickstarter buyer and a buyer on Amazon is quite significant. And none of those sales on Kickstarter are reflected on any list. So even though I sold over 5,000 books just on the Kickstarter, none of those 5,000 were ever reflected on in an Amazon algorithm or in any other algorithm. So that's the one kind of reality that you have to be aware of, mm-hmm. is that it won't immediately have an effect on your sales ranking on other retailers. That's just not realistic. But what I did is I bought a bunch of courses. I bought Brian Cohen's course. I bought Mark's ad course. And I started to slowly take care of the fundamentals, the foundational stuff, so that when I was able to publish book four, I saw a significant increase in my income for every month. And it's continuing to go up because I was careful about not sort of throwing all my eggs into one basket, but to do this more steadily. And I'm a wide author. I'm not somebody who does Kindle Unlimited. I'm looking at this as a long game.
So, yeah. So the Kickstarter project was a sort of separate seed of money that you could use for a specific purpose or whatever you wanted to do, or even to start funding ads campaigns. But you should also be looking at the whole Amazon platform and other retailers if you're wide platform as well, in the same way, almost regardless of the fact that you had a successful Kickstarter project.
I think so. And I think Kickstarter is just another another avenue for marketing, one that's not particularly very often used. And that's unfortunate. And I think there's going to be a movement towards doing it more often for fiction. In fact, there's now and I'm going to do a plug here. It's not for my own course, but Dean Wesley Smith and Christine Catherine Rush are actually offering a free course right now on fiction Kickstarters. And the reason that I'm happy to recommend Dean's course is because I actually emailed him during the course of my Kickstarter. And those of you who don't know, Dean and Chris are basically sort of a certain kind of standard bearer in the indie movement. They offer excellent educational opportunities, both online and in person. And they've both published over 75 novels. They're sort of what everybody should try to become in a lot of ways. But I emailed him with the link to my Kickstarter when it was active. And he said that it was one of the best Kickstarters that he'd ever seen. So he is a really good resource for this because he knows what he's talking about. They've funded over 10 Kickstarters of their own. So that's happening right now. So it's a good time, actually. In fact, I only found this course this morning. It was only announced late last week. So it's a good time to start looking into this as a potential avenue.
And was this different genres, or is this all epic fantasy?
No, this is fiction.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just whatever. Yeah, no, so yeah. It could be romance. Thrillers.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
Okay. And your project, which I'm sort of would like to see now, but I guess it's down now because it's funded, or is it still there?
It's still there.
If you send us the link, we'll include the link in the show notes for this episode so people can have a look at what we're talking about. So one thing you mentioned, which we haven't talked about yet, is the video.
Yeah.
So you have to have a video with a Kickstarter project, or is it an optional extra?
You don't have to. It's optional, but it's much harder to fund if you don't have one, because let's face it, we're a video based culture. No, it's actually important, and there are a few sort of do's and don'ts that I could talk about specifically that might be helpful for anybody who's interested.
Yeah, go ahead.
You want to do your research and see what other people are doing, but do it with kind of a bit of discernment, because if you look at somebody like Michael J. Sullivan, who is extremely successful on Kickstarter, he basically funds most of his books with, you know, several multi six figure funding Kickstarters, and everybody knows him as the Kickstarter guy. He does videos that are basically he can do anything. He can just turn on the video, talk to the camera. He can say stupid things and everybody will still buy it because he is who he is. So for most of us, that's, you know, we don't have the personality people don't know us yet. There are some things you probably should keep in mind. One is that people's attention span is extremely short. So if you can keep your video under 1 minute, that would be better. And the other thing that you really want to do is you want to structure your video like the hero's journey. So, but again, the hero is not you, but the reader. So you need to have basically six elements to your video and only one or two sentences for each of the elements. You start with a hook, and the hook is going to be unique to your project. And in my case, the hook was the idea that wouldn't it be cool, wouldn't it be interesting for you to take part in the creation of a novel? And it was a kind of an unexpected hook, not one that people were had seen a lot of, so it worked well for me. You follow the hook with a setup, and that setup is like you introducing yourself as the sort of mentor, the Gandalf figure. Like, I'm here and I'm going to take you on this journey. And you need to make that as interesting and as exciting as possible, because what you follow with is the problem. And the problem is always going to be the same, which is, I don't have enough money to do this on my own. And this is the scariest and the most difficult bit, because you have to phrase it in a way that doesn't turn people off. So you will have to have given them an interesting enough hook and an exciting enough setup so that they can sort of grin and bear it through the struggle, because you want to carry them through the problem and the struggle, where you explain why Kickstarter is what it is and why it's a good thing and why it isn't a platform for charity, but it's a platform for pre-orders. You have to stress that a lot. And then you provide them with a solution, which is that we together are going on this journey where you are going to receive that which I promise. And that can be different depending on the genre. Most of the time you're focusing specifically on entertainment value. And you end with a specific call to action. And that call to action has to be as specific as, so make sure to grab a copy of book title now in the sidebar, and you point at the sidebar for however many dollars. So you're specifically telling them to go to one of the tiers. And the tiers can go from $2 to infinity. But you want to pick the one that's most appealing and the one that gives the best value. So I pointed them towards the $20 one. And knowing that if they were interested enough to look at that, they would keep scrolling, and maybe the $100 one would interest them, which is what happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm scrolling. I found the page. In fact, if I just Google Kickstarter, Nick Kotar, it came up. And so it's very interesting. I see what you mean about the entry level one. $5 for all three ebooks is a good price and would keep people interested on the page. And I guess once people have decided that they're going to be a part of this, I'm already scrolling there. Well, I'm going to buy it. I may as well go for something that's going to give me a shot at that sword. There's the $100 one I'm seeing now. And there was 150. Now, and something that's been answered here, looking at the page, I was going to ask you, and I would have guessed a higher number. It's actually the total number of backers is lower than I thought it was going to be. So you made $25,798 from just 776 backers. I say just, that's a hell of an achievement, but I kind of thought it was going to be 1,000 backers at $5. I think, well, my maths aren't good. But that's only 776.
Well, that's the thing. Most people think that you're going to get the vast majority of your supporters at a lower tier. That's not necessarily the case. It's much more, basically, in all crowdfunding, you want to find a sweet spot that isn't too low, but that isn't high enough that it's going to scare people. So that's why I made the hard sell for the $20 one, knowing that there would be perhaps other incentives to push them higher up.
Yeah. And your average sale was over $30. Your average backer. Yeah.
I mean, I had a few $500 ones also, and which helped.
As we're doing the interview, I'm not going to click on this now, but if we click on the main picture, is that where you get the video from?
It would have been.
Yeah. So I can see it's come out of the play thing here, just so people know how to, it's there. It's there,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, it's there. Yeah.
Well, that's really interesting. And there is a bit of this going on at the moment. As you say, you've alluded to a few people are using Kickstarter. I think we should reiterate again that you only go into this and do this with a 100% guarantee to yourself that you are going to deliver what you're promising, because this will very quickly get a very bad rep with the reading public and the backing public if too many authors spoil the fun for everyone else. So
exactly.
And you know, that's does happen in any online business. You will get some bad actors. Let's make sure we're not them. Great. Well, it's really fascinating, actually. A new stream of income. I think a lot of the rest of this year is going to be about diversification of income.
Yeah.
And not necessarily relying on your employer or on any one source of income, but having different ways of doing things. And people are going to spend a bit more time at home and on digital environments. And so this sort of ticks a lot of those boxes, I think.
Well, and not only that, it also ticks the box of community building. And I think that for as much as people are going to be talking about social distancing, what people are not talking about, but what people really want is to make up for that community that they're going to be missing out on because they're no longer, you know, going to public places as often. And, you know, so often we get so negative about social media and about the virtual aspect of online communities. But now, more than ever before, this is a real advantage because people are going to be looking specifically for that. So if you can really focus on that aspect of it. And really for me, this was the reason, you know, one of the reasons why it was successful is because I made sure to do a lot of preliminary communication with people one-on-one to tell them that I was going to do this. So it wasn't me just waiting for this thing to launch and then just start looking for people. I tried to build the community in advance. And what that did is that on day three of the launch, no, sorry, within one day, within 24 hours of the launch, I had actually already funded. And then what Kickstarter did is that they did me a favor and they made it into one of the projects that they love. Right. And so this is why, this is how Kickstarter is better than a lot of the other platforms, is that it has its own internal system that if you manage to trigger it, you get a tremendous boost. And okay, I'll tell you, 75% of my backers came internally from Kickstarter itself.
Yeah, so that's one area we haven't specifically talked about, is how you marketed and raised visibility of this project. But obviously, it's a bit like the Amazon algorithm. If you can get things going yourself, the algorithm will start to help you.
Yeah, and to do that, you have to have a lot of initial support. So there are a few numbers that you can talk about. One of them is if you can reach 40% within the first week, you're almost guaranteed to fund. And the other one is if you can get people to commit verbally to 40% before you begin, then that is a good indicator that you're going to be able to do this well and that you're probably going to fund it. Because Kickstarter, unlike the other ones, if you don't fund completely, you don't get any of it. Yeah. So that's the risk.
Yeah.
But the risk is worth the reward if you're able to get the algorithms on your side.
And where did you find your initial backers then? Is this your mailing list or?
So I started with my mailing list, and this is the weird thing. It was almost entirely due to personal messaging on Facebook. So because most of the time people tell you, you know, David Goggren and other people like this tell you, do not market your books to your own family and friends because they're going to mess up your also bots, right? This is the exact opposite. You want to find every single person you know on every single social network that you can find, message them personally and tell them about what you're doing. Because if you send a mass mailing, they won't, there's no incentive to answer you. But, and some of my friends didn't answer also. I mean, I didn't get a perfect 100% answer rate, but because I wasn't worried about messing up the also bots, it meant that I could go after people that weren't normally my reader. And for the initial 40%, that's fine. You don't need to have readers in your genre. You just need to have readers who are willing to put up the money. They might not even read your book.
Or
it doesn't matter.
Or just friends who want to support your project. Yeah.
Right. Right. Exactly. And if you have enough of those, and so I made sure that I had enough promised that it would be able to cover the 40. And then I asked them specifically, you know, support me within this time period. And I was pretty active during the first 24 hours, reminding people and getting them excited and making sure to focus on the community building aspect of it. And because of that, it shot up through the gate immediately and you just kept going.
Like a virus taking hold in the population. that kind of.
I didn't want to go there.
We've got to keep laughing, otherwise we're just going to stop.
No, okay. It's true.
Okay. Well, look, that's brilliant. We've had a fantastic chat about this. I've, of course, been bombarded with messages. I'm sorry if I looked a bit distracted in the middle of that.
No, you're fine.
But it's been gripping, and I think people are all ears for different avenues of marketing as things unfold and become, you know, in a couple of years' time, this could be a very mainstream thing that authors do. But at the moment, it's an outlying thing. That's where we want our audience, the audience of this podcast, is where we want them to be. So at the beginning of those curves, ahead of those curves. Fantastic. Yep. Nick, great pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. You too, James. Yeah.
Hunker down, as we're all going to do now. Let's see you on the other side, and we'll hear about your next thing, whatever it is, in the future.
Thank you, James.
This is the Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
There we go. Nick Kotar, really interesting experience there. And as he said, his GoFundMe, I don't know if it was GoFundMe, I can't remember now, having done the interview, but whichever site it is, it's mentioned in the interview and it's still there. So you can see all those tears he gave out and the comments he got back and all the rest of it. I mean, crowdfunding is suddenly, I mean, it's been around for a few years. I've used it a couple of times in other projects outside of SPF, my local cricket club. This year, actually, we've had our finances saved from using a crowdfunding campaign, because without cricket, without social events, without subs and match fees, we have no money coming in and all the bills still going out. And we needed, not very much, but we needed £5,000 to survive this COVID period. I used crowdfunding and we've raised that money in about 2.5 weeks, which is fantastic. So crowdfunding is being used all over the place at the moment. There's a very ancient soldier in the UK called Captain Tom, who walks with a Zimmer frame.
Colonel Tom.
Is he a colonel? No, he's captain, isn't he?
No, he was given an honorary
promotion. Now colonel. Sorry, sir. Who's raised something like £25 million.
Keep going.
More than that, 40 odd million.
40 million.
40-odd million pounds through crowdfunding. So there is, you know, that's an example.
Walking around his garden.
Walking around his garden for the British.
I could do that.
For the UK NHS. Yeah, just about. But it just goes to show that crowdfunding is a billion-dollar turnover business, and it is perhaps something we should be thinking about.
We're thinking about Kickstarter for a comic project that I'm doing with my brother at the moment. So the Beatrix books, we may look at doing a Kickstarter for those potentially. So it's definitely a big interesting industry. And I've had some good interviews actually with the Six Figure Author podcast had a good interview with I don't know who it was now, but someone who did very well with Kickstarters. And I've also seen, I won't name names here, but I have seen some authors, or one in particular, who's kicked off Amazon for being a bit naughty with regards to, well, some alleged nefarious behaviour. And he moved over to Kickstarter. He's got lots of fans, and he was able, I think he's able to like generate $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 for every book that he launches. So he actually has used that now to sidestep Amazon, doesn't need to use them to distribute anymore. He's probably making more money as well, because he'll be getting more than, you know, the Kickstarter angle will be less than the 30% he's giving to Amazon in terms of the royalty. So probably making more money. So it's just another way to reach a different community of people who'd be interested in your stuff. So it's definitely an interesting growth area.
Yes, of course, Kickstarter was the platform he used, but it has slightly different rules from some of the other crowdfunding, which Nick does explain in the interview. Good. Well, it's all interesting area of the sort of digital landscape that's ahead of us now. There are nooks and crannies all over the place, and definitely something to think about. Maybe it's the sort of thing that authors who collaborate could do. I was thinking about the billionaire women, the brilliant four authors who put together that reverse billionaire series. That's the sort of thing I could imagine their fans would pay for on Kickstarter and feel a part of and get some special bundles when it comes out. Sort of thing would lend itself to. Just a chance to use your imagination about that. Good. Okay, quick reminder, if you go to selfpublishingforum.com/6secrets, SIXSECRETS, you can sign up for that exciting Amazon Ads webinar with the one and only Janet Margot in the beginning of June. It's going to fill up, so you will have to be there early. I think that's it, Mark. You can go back to the garden and try and tackle Samuel again, try and get some revenge.
Yeah, I'm going to do a Boris Johnson two-footed challenge. Two-footed challenge.
Do you think Boris Johnson...
It's actually worth... It's worth it. People should probably look that up. If you do Boris Johnson and rugby and child, it's probably worth... It's worth seeing that.
It's not just rugby. He also did a very similar football, rugby tackle in a football game as well. I don't think he really...
He did a two-footed tackle on Frank Lampard or something. Yeah, someone like that. So he is basically... a bit of a thug. Anyway,
he's a liability on the sports pitch. That's it. Okay, good. Thank you very much indeed, Mark. All that leaves me to say is that it's been a great show. Thank you for joining us. I think it's been a great show. I say that myself. And it's a goodbye from him.
And it's a goodbye from me. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Get show notes, the podcast archive, and free resources to boost your writing career at selfpublishingshow.com. Join our thriving Facebook group at selfpublishingshow.com/Facebook. Support the show at patreon.com/selfpublishingshow. and join us next week for more help and inspiration so that you can make your mark as a successful indie author. Publishing is changing, so get your words into the world and join the revolution with The Self-Publishing Show.